the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week is D-Day veteran Harley Reynolds, the staff sergeant of B Company, 16th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division, that hit the beaches of Omaha on June 6, 1944.
Well, I enlisted in, on the, I took the oath on December the 28th in 1940, and I had a neighbor buddy that was a year or two older than me that had enlisted in the Army about 6 months before, and he'd come home on furlough, and I fell in love with the uniform, and that was the start of it. Well, I was 16 in October, and I went in December. You're supposed to be 18, but they didn't check on you in those days. They were too happy just to get another count, you know. Let's see, when I enlisted, I went into Fort Jay, New York. That's on Governor's Island in New York City. And then we moved to Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And then from Fort Devens, Massachusetts, we made a couple of practice invasions, one in Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts, and one down off the coast of North Carolina. Then moved to Camp Blanding, Florida, and we were told that it was preparation or training and preparation for going to the Pacific Theater. But all just out of a clear blue sky, let's say, they changed their mind, and in very short order, we were shipped to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, and re-equipped with winter clothes or woolen ODs, and stuck on Queen Mary, the entire division, and shipped to Scotland. And from Scotland, we took a train down to Idworth Barracks, which is a central part of England, near Salisbury. That's where we trained for the invasion of Africa. But up until that point, it was just regular army life, parades, and close order drill, and rifle marksmanship, and just the standard stuff for infantry.
Retired Staff Sergeant Reynolds reflects on the various training he received before the invasions of Africa and Sicily.
Well, an invasion is an invasion. The terrain might differ a little bit, but more or less face the same risk and hazards. Someone's going to be shooting at you when you go in, you know.
Right.
So there wasn't a lot of difference. The Africa is what I would call a walk-on, and so was Sicily. We didn't face any fire as we were going into Africa. It didn't start until about 9:30 in the morning there. And it didn't start until the following morning in Sicily. Just luck or fate, whatever.
On June 6, 1944, while aboard the troop ship the Samuel Chase, Harley Reynolds prepared for the battle ahead on the beaches of Omaha.
There are many things, of course. It's hard to... I could just describe life as it was at that particular hour or day, and the conversation among us. When we left Sicily, we had seen a lot of action by that time, while other troops had not seen any at all. And we just felt that we were being picked on instead of chosen. I heard comments, Sergeant Reynolds, you think we'll make it through this one? Our luck's got to run out sometime. Just the mind is dwelling on it, and what we were going to face on that beach. We knew it was going to be bad, and because of the training that they had put us through. And trained us for, all the different obstacles and so forth that we'd run into. It was a little different fighting there than in the open desert or the open mountains of Sicily. And the emplacements, the trenches, they had the preparations that the Germans had made to try to keep us from getting onto that beast to get a foothold. Well, I can recall that the smiles, you know, the comments and the smiles that are made are not very encouraging, you know. Most of the men are down on one knee or both knees or hunkered down so that they could use the boat itself for cover from the rifle fire and the machine gun fire or the small arms fire from the beach. And when the ramp went down, we were up and in a dead run to get off of that boat and get inland, to get out of the fire, because inland is where it was the safer place. And we were making an effort to get inland. But I was on the right side of the boat, and my radio man, the company radio man, was on my left. There was no one in between us. And about the first or second step onto the ramp, he was hit and the radio was hit, and he went down on the ramp. And I kept going for about 20 or 30 yards on shore. And then I went down on one knee behind a what they called a hedgehog. It was an obstacle that the Germans had placed on the beach to wreck our boats. And you know that I can't remember looking back. The last look that I had of that radio man was him crumpled up on his side like on the beach. He was lying on his left side and almost looking back into the boat. And that's the last image that I could recall of him. But then the fire is so intense on that beach. So many bullets flying in the air and about you and between your legs, under your arms. The bullets are just like a real disturbed beehive. And that was the greatest concern at that time. So with your thinking and your looking, where is the cover, you know? We were promised that there would be many bombs and rocket shells that would have landed on that beach to give us some cover, some foxholes, or make do foxholes just for cover. But there wasn't anything. The sand was perfectly smooth from the tide going out, and except for where the shells were hitting. And I think at times that possibly the sand was actually saved their lives. I think that the mortar shells and artillery shells that were coming in would go a little bit deeper into the soil or into the sand before they exploded. And at that point, most of the shrapnel would go straight up in the air instead of to the side, as it would do where the soil was firmer. But I don't know. I'm not a specialist in that type of analyzing anyway. But from there on, I only spent seconds behind that hedgehog, and I took off for the dry land, let's say. And I made it all the way in one run. And I don't dare guess how far it was, because it seemed further than what it actually was, I'm sure. All the way in, you're looking, you can see people, the shells hitting, and men going down, being hit from the shrapnel and from the machine gun fire. I met a man that was firing, a German man that had fired on me late, later on, but only about 5 years ago I met him. He made many comments, but one that he made to me is that he just fired until he didn't understand how there could still be men standing up and still running and coming on. He said that it seemed to him like there was just no end to the men coming onto that beach. But I made it to the safest place on that beach was the built-up embankment that they call shingles, and it was rock. It was all rock that resembled a river rock, as we call them. They used them in flower beds and so forth back here in the States, in lawns and whatnot. But they were so deep that a tank or a truck could not get over them. They'd just sink into them, and that's as far as they could move. And on top of this embankment of shingles was the barbed wire, and it stopped us cold, because all the men that had been assigned and given tools to cut wire and Bangalore torpedoes to stick under the wire and blow it, most of these men were already wounded and not able to. They were wounded or killed, and they weren't able to do their job. And a lot of what I'd consider pretty intelligent men have asked the question, what held us up on that beach? Why didn't we? One man asked me why I didn't jump on it, like one of the men in a movie that I saw. He falls across the wire, and the men walk across his back to get across it. But this wire is some 7 feet high. It wasn't made in Hollywood, it was made to work.
We're talking this week with Omaha Beach veteran Harley Reynolds, and we'll continue our conversation after we return on Veterans Chronicles. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. We're joined this week by World War II veteran Harley Reynolds to continue his story of Omaha Beach.
It just wasn't possible, because if you stood up to then you got shot. It was that simple. Beach stuff for a while was shot, and the statistics are that in the first 20 to 30 minutes is when the most of the casualties were on that beach, and at that point, it was two out of every four men. The casualties were 50% in that first 20 minutes, a half hour. I have an idea of how intense that it was. People... Of course, we had 2,300 casualties from our regiment on that beach. That's a lot of casualties in that short of time. Another statistic that I'm reminded of was that 70 to 80% of the men that were killed on that beach were shot in the head. And That was rifle fire. Machine gun fire doesn't, because they took aim at your head. Those were the riflemen in the trenches and so forth that were on that beach. They had it covered pretty good. Well, just as it so happened, my luck was good. It turned out good. I'm looking. I'm raising my head up and looking to see what the heck I'd been looking behind and watching the things that had been that were happening behind me. I saw many men hit and killed and wounded and so forth. But I was looking ahead, raising my head, taking a real fast look ahead, and at the wire, and just thinking of what could I do if I was through this wire. I wasn't thinking about getting through it, but what could I do if I was through it? It might seem strange. But anyway, I had decided that if I was through that wire, then there was a small pond there, and we still had our life preservers on to get across that pond because they didn't really know how deep it was. They knew it was there, and they warned us to keep our life belts to make it across that pond. Well, while I'm taking these fast looks, a small man in stature, called up on my right side and with a Bangalore torpedo, and I knew what he was immediately. But now this is some hour and 15 minutes of lying there behind this shingle embankment being shot at, and the mortars and the artillery fire being dropped on us. As soon as he put the Bangalore torpedo is in two sections. It's screwed together in what they call a bayonet clip and a type of an attachment. When he started shoving that first half under that wire, I screamed out to my two squad leaders. I had talked to them several times up until that point, asking them after a shell or burst of machine gun fire had come in on us real close. I'd ask them above the noise. You know, it was terribly noisy, and you had to yell and scream to be heard. And I had called on them several times if they were okay, if the men are still okay. And anyway, when this man started putting the Bangalore under the wire, I yelled at Sergeant Hoy, the one who answered me first. I said, "We're going through." And he just nodded yes at me. He understood. And then the man put the other half, it wouldn't reach all the way across the barbed wire entanglement. So he put the other half, shoved it under it, and he pulled the fuse cord to ignite it and backed up a couple of steps. He's crawfishing backwards. And he made a couple of moves backwards, and nothing happened. The fuse lighter was either wet or bad, or whatever. It did not explode. And the man didn't hesitate. After giving it time to go off, which is just seconds, he right back up to it, pulled it out, replaced it with a good one, a good igniter, and looked backwards to see if he could move backwards, and when he looked backwards, he looked right into my eyes, and at that second, when he pulled that string and started moving backwards, he was looking right into my eyes when he was hit and killed. His head was only maybe 3 feet from that wire, but all the explosion from those Bangalores went upward and outward. He wasn't damaged from the Bangalore. He was killed by, I believe, rifle fire, not a machine gun, because there wasn't that much, that many bullets that came in. It was like just one bullet hit him, and he was gone. That man, to this day, has not been identified or recognized. And of all the monuments that they have and grave markings and missing and so forth on Omaha Beach, boy, it would sure make me feel good to know that man was recognized, because to me, he was the greatest hero on that beach. He deserved all the medals that everyone else earned on that beach.
We're talking with Omaha Beach veteran Harley Reynolds, and we'll continue our conversation after we return on Veterans Chronicles.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiaxin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
We'll have the air conditioner and we'll all.
We cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. We're joined this week by Omaha Beach veteran Harley Reynolds, the first man through the wire on June 6, 1944.
He opened up the beach, and as Colonel Taylor, our regimental commander, that's where he went through. But when I went through that wire, I was the first one through that wire. The Bangalore goes off, and I'm up and through that wire. And across the pond, but it took us a while to get to the top of the hill. Remember, the war is still going on. They're still shooting at us. Every foot of ground that you gained on that beach was fought for. We had the mines. The mines on that, half of our casualties on that beach were from mines. It was absolutely seeded with mines. Once I made it across the pond, that's when one of my... the comedian, so-called company comedian, he was wounded going across that pond. And I heard my name being called, and I turned around and looked at it, and it is Donald Heath holding his arm up and the blood just spurting from it. And he's yelling and laughing and saying, stateside, stateside. He'd gotten that wound that would get him back to the States. And it did. But he was wounded the second time before he got off that beach and strung out in formation, more or less, behind me, following me, because no one wanted to lead the way because of the mines, you know. And I had two men in front of me. One of them passed me by. I was moving a little too slow for him, I guess. He passed me by and only got 20 or 30 feet from me. He tripped a wire that was tied to a fence post as he went by it, and it blew him in half. So that slowed people down for a minute. They started looking a little closer for the mines again. But I turned at that point, started going directly up the bluff, and had gone only maybe 20 or 30 yards up the bluff when the same thing happened. Here comes another man. But he thought that his platoon was up ahead of him, and he was trying to catch up. He was a runner for the second platoon. And he stepped on a mine just 10 or 12 feet in front of me and blew his heel off. These things are happening in front of you the whole time on that beach. That sort of slowed people down behind me again, so it made me and my platoon sergeant were the first two men to the top of that bluff, and I was possibly a little bit ahead of him because I had to sort of look back downhill more or less to my right to see him and signal him and so forth. A lot of things happened on that beach that I can recall. One was that we had a first sergeant in B Company who moved to A Company. We got in an extra first sergeant from the States as a replacement for the invasion. That gave us two first sergeants, and A Company didn't have one, so they transferred transferred him to A Company as first sergeant of A Company. And he, while Sergeant Swanger and I standing at the top of that hill looking back on the beach and trying to get organized, and that making sure that all of our men are caught up so we can continue inland, because we were in a little bit of safety there. The bullets aren't flying. They were flying over our head at that point. So were the shells and from the artillery. The sergeant that passed to Zinsky was the first sergeant that was transferred to A Company. He came by and he said to Sergeant Swagner, he said, "Well," he said, "I see you've made it this far." And then we didn't see him again ever. Very short, in a few short days after that day, he was made a first lieutenant. And he went on to retire as a major in Fort Benning, Georgia. And I found him about 3 years after he was dead. But then I set up a machine gun and fired on some entrenchments that were to our right. Then that's where I got to separate the company, because I had the machine gun to break down and follow the company. They were going inland at that point. And that's when I looked back and saw this enemy activity in these entrenchments across the draw on our right. And I had a machine gun set up and fire on them. And then people from the outfit that was on our right, they came up over the bluff and started throwing grenades at them, and I couldn't fire anymore because of the risk of hitting their own men. So I told the machine gun to break down and catch up with the company, and I don't know what made me hesitate for a minute and look back, but there was still more enemy over there. So I started shooting at them with just my rifle at that point. And this was only a few very short minutes, but everyone moving forward, that caused a little separation between me and them at that point, and it took me 24 hours to catch up with them. It was bad that first night and the second night. The Germans were mixed in with us, and they were trying to get inland to get to their own troops and to reorganize and so forth. In the middle of the night, boy, you'd be trying to catch a wink of sleep, and the shooting would start up, the bullets zinging around your ears, and all night long that way. We had almost a half a company of Germans that tried to break through our line, and we captured all of them. We did it by signal flares that we sent for the light that the flares gave off, because it was dark. But we captured all of those, and there was almost a half a company of Germans in that group. The fighting, as we went inland, we lost many, many men. Our company, before the war ended, my company was replaced about three or four times. That's how great the casualties were, because we were fighting what they called the bocage, which was the hedgerow country.
Harley Reynolds wrote his book, How I Survived the Three First Wave Invasions, to combat the misinformation historians continue to circulate regarding the events of World War II.
It was just that I disputed a lot of the things that were written and a lot of the things that they left out, which caused so much confusion. There is still no answer to a lot of really good history of incidents on that beach. And there's one that I disagree with very strenuously. They said it's in our history book that Lieutenant Spaulding was the first one in the area that I was the first one. What can I say? I saw him come through the. We didn't know it was him at the time, but we saw the Bangalore torpedo blow a gap in the wire about 300 yards to our left, and. That, according to the evidence that I can find in my research, he tells himself about coming through that wire. And he doesn't know who it was that blew the hole in the wire that he came through, just like I did. But he said the hole was there and he went through it. The history of the beach engineers or they were the ones that were managing the traffic and getting everything organized and getting it off the beach and so forth. And they have their own history, and that was by the Coast Guard. And they mentioned in there that there was one other explosion or Bangalore torpedo, they identified, that exploded on that beach at just the point where I just described. It was about 300 yards to our left. And Sergeant Swanger and I were at the top of the bluff when that Bangalore went off. And yet he hadn't come through the wire yet. And yet he was the first one to the top of the hill where Sergeant Swanger and I were the first. But and that's there are so many little things like that that I can testify to that to me is truth. It's that and someone who, that a lot of the history of things that happened on that beach, they were sitting in a foxhole back there, hidden someplace, and trying to imagine what was going on. As an example, our history book says that my boat, which was the our company headquarters boat, took three direct hits and was sunk when it hit that beach. Nothing else, period. And yet, here I am, you know. And, they assumed, see, the radio man that went down on the boat ramp, he was knocked out, so was the company radio was knocked out, and contact couldn't be made with B Company by our battalion. So they assumed that we were knocked out. Now, what do you, you don't assume history for crying out loud. I'm very proud to have written it. I was advised by a very good friend that my book was my book, and that's the way it should be written. It should be more directly reflective of me and what I did, exactly as I would say it, be me. Not a lot of so-called highfalutin English and so forth. Tell it like it is, regardless of how raw it is. There's a lot of action in that book that was never reported in our history books. A lot of things that happened. One of the greatest things that happened was the bombing at St. Lo, which was the only time I was wounded during the war. And they don't even give it a paragraph of that bombing and the breakthrough that we made there. Perhaps that hint that it failed, that it was rained out, and all kinds of things. Hell, there was 3,400 bombers that all of them dropping their bomb in one little square area. And they don't talk about it. They don't describe it. To me, that's why I say to me, there's so much that was omitted and so much that is erroneously misstated. I don't say intentionally, but just plain wrong. There's nothing wrong with correction. Just like we had a little company critique shortly after the invasion. And to try to get things together as to what actually happened on that beach, determined that B Company was supposed to have landed in the reserve wave, not the first wave. It was supposed to have been the second wave. But C Company, which we were supposed to have followed on that beach, mislanded. They landed 500 to 600 yards to the left of where they were supposed to be landing. They had to fight their way, not inland, but back along that beach through all the fire that was being directed at them. They suffered terrible casualties from that. A Company went in where they were supposed to, but they had to cross a big tank trap that was there that they weren't warned about, and that they lost almost half of the company just in that tank trap. But anyway, C Company out of position and us following them, it put us right in where they were supposed to have landed. And B Company landed full strength, all six boats. We didn't lose a boat going in there. We were more organized, as luck would have it. And we accomplished more on that beach than the whole battalion put together did. And that's not brought out in the history books. And fortunately, I have a video camera tapes of interviews with my men. I knew the resistance that I would face when I started writing my book, correcting all this stuff and pointing it out. That's not the way that had happened. This is the way it happened. So I interviewed these men and got their report of how they saw it and how it happened. And it's no different than the way I tell it. I'm prepared to face anyone that tell me I don't know what I'm talking about or some such thing.
Along with fellow World War II veterans, Harley Reynolds recently returned from visiting Normandy for the 65th anniversary of D-Day.
Well, of course, this was my sixth trip back there since the year 2000. My first trip there was emotionally uncontrollable, very bad in that sense. The second and third one were almost as bad. To walk through that cemetery and breaks me up a little bit there's more than just one, but I stopped at this one, and I couldn't go any further until I was able to get my composure back. On the headstone, it says unknown. It was just the parts of a body that they picked up and weren't able to identify. But there's a grave there for them, but there's no name on it. And that just tears me up, because the mother or the family of that man don't know what happened to him. All they know is that he's gone. He didn't come back. As you know, or have learned by now, that I love talking about the war. I understand the people that can't talk about it, because it was bad. I had best friends that couldn't talk about it. They're gone now. Fortunately for me, I can. And if it's accepted, and most of the time it is, then I've enlightened a few people.
Thanks to World War II veteran Harley Reynolds of B Company, 16th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division. In addition to storming the beaches of Omaha on June 6, 1944, details of his earlier combat experiences can be found in his book, How I Survived the Three First Wave Invasions, North Africa, Sicily, and Omaha Beach.
Veterans Chronicles is now podcasting at RadioAmerica.org. Log on to our website, click on the podcasting icon, and look for Veterans Chronicles. Once there, follow the instructions on your computer to subscribe to our podcast. You'll always find our most recent program on the Veterans Chronicles podcast, in addition to past programs from our archives. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, free and online at RadioAmerica.org. Also available on Apple iTunes.
Welcome to Profiles in Valor, stories of decorated men and women serving in today's military.
Our guest today is Major David Williams, Jr., recipient of the Bronze Star for actions serving in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Major Williams, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be on your show.
From what I understand, you deployed for your second tour in Iraq in February 2007 as the plans liaison officer for coalition forces and a planner for the 3rd Infantry Division. Can you tell us a little bit about the role of a planner in a combat zone like Iraq?
We're extremely busy planning operations, tactical operations and non-tactical operations regarding deployments and various different topics that we plan. We're basically the commander gives us his intent and his guidance, and what the planner tries to do is similar to like a project manager in the civilian world, but you take that intent and guidance and you try to come up with a feasible and executable plan to make that the commander's intent and guidance make it happen and turn into reality.
And you worked quite a bit with not just U.S. forces from the 3rd ID while in Iraq, but also from other countries who are part of the coalition. Can you tell us a little bit about working with the two as it pertains to your role as a planner?
Right. Yeah, that was a really neat experience working with the coalition. I didn't know it was going to happen when I went into Iraq, but I got tasked with Georgian Brigade. They were actually the third largest contributor to Iraq at that period of time, and sent up to the country of Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia, to plan their exercises and prepare them for operations in Iraq and preparing them to work under 3ID. So what we did was took a lot of our standard operating procedures and report formats and got them translated into Georgian and to facilitate the exercise. But we also came up with an event list that ran the exercise based off the kind of situations that they would likely encounter in Iraq. And I came up with those, and it was a neat experience. And we also shared a lot of current intelligence with them to prepare them. And it was just neat, the personal relationships that we built with their brigade staff before we came into Iraq and the sharing of information and just kind of familiarization with the coalition. I mean, overall, I worked with the El Salvadorians and Kazakhs and Lithuanians as well, and to kind of help plan their training either in their home country or what they received in Kuwait prior to them coming into Iraq. I also had the opportunity to, work with a lot of their senior officers, and so I just learned a lot from them. It was a unique perspective, being a planner and working with these coalition forces and just getting their perspective on the enemy and their perspective on doing business. And they bring a lot of capabilities to the fight, and it was just great to work with them. It was really an experience, and I just really enjoyed it.
And how is it different between you're working with them and American forces? What did you pick up on in your dealings with them?
Obviously, we had some language barriers, which caused some problems, which we tried to, hire some interpreters to facilitate communications between us, but it was very difficult sometimes to find somebody who could speak Georgian, Russian, Arabic, English. Sometimes when the Georgians were dealing with the Iraqis, they have two or three interpreters in a discussion to translate a conversation. So they have some communication issues there, but I try to resolve them again with developing personal relationships with them. We had some equipment challenges. A lot of the coalition equipment didn't interact with our own equipment, and we had to find some workarounds with that. For example, their machine gun mounts, their Soviet-style machine guns didn't fit into our Humvee gun mounts. So we had some people in Kuwait fabricate, 300 of these adapters to adapt their Soviet-style machine guns into American-style Humvees. So challenges along, the communication and equipment integration. But they're seemed motivated. They had high morale to be there. They're glad to be there, and it's really neat working with them.
And I should note that your exercises that you worked with on with the Georgians were the first American exercises to really take place in a former Soviet republic, correct?
Right, of this nature, yeah. I think we've been in Georgia for about 4 or 5 years before I got there with forces conducting training. But this is the first computers simulated command post exercise, secret exercise, to prepare them for their operations in combat. It was neat to be a part of that, and we had people from the States and Europe fly in to facilitate this exercise, and then the group that I brought up with me from Iraq. It was a really neat experience to be up there and work with the Georgians.
Well, what can you say about the changes in efficiency you saw while working with the Georgians and the other members of the coalition as time progressed?
They definitely became more proficient. Just like American forces, when you first come into Iraq, the first few months, you're just kind of understanding the situation, and there was really no difference with the coalition forces. Just kind of settling in, understanding the terrain, understanding the Iraqis that you're dealing with, understand who the enemy is, and they became really proficient at operations, and they became proficient in what they're doing, and it was great to see that over a period of time.
Your second deployment began there in February 2007, so you were really there during some critical times during the war in Iraq. What was your sense of how things were going during that time and leading up to where we're at today?
Right. When I began my second tour, which was on 5 days' notice, I was the advance party for 3ID at the theater. The rest of the division headquarters came about a month and a half behind me. Yeah, it was a tough time. I think General Petraeus had just come in like the month or two prior. So there was definitely some change in direction needed in Iraq. The insurgency was full-flung at that time. I think 2006 was probably the worst year in Iraq. And, we were part of the surge. We were the division headquarters to kind of command and control those five brigades going into Iraq. Yeah, it was a critical time. It was really neat being a planner and also, working at CORE, Multinational CORE Iraq, and being exposed to that high-level decision-making of the plans. And over a 15-month deployment, seeing those plans and the commander's intent and guidance where he wanted to take it, the end state of Iraq. And about 15 months later, you really saw the fruits of our labor with our planning efforts as far as on-the-ground changes that were occurring in a positive direction, with the irreversible momentum, as we called it, of the Iraqis taking charge and being the lead, both the government and their army. And then, last month, a year after return, but the Iraqis are clearly in the lead in Iraq.
What have you been doing since your tour, and what are your plans for the future?
For about 6 or 7 months, I went back to Fort Stewart, Georgia, and was still a planner there. We were quite busier than I expected to be back stateside, working on a few different projects. December, I moved to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas to begin the Command and General Staff College in February. Been in that for about 6 months, really enjoying it. And I was applied and accepted into the School of Advanced Military Studies. I'm going to be at Fort Leavenworth for another year. And then after that, I'll probably go to a Corps level or higher command level headquarters to be a planner.
Well, we certainly wish you best of luck, and Major David Williams, Jr., thank you for your service.
Profiles in Valor is produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. To hear more profiles, subscribe on iTunes or visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.